Right. Well, thanks for that, Naguna. My preparation for this talk has been a bit slightly weird. I've been in Cyprus for the last 2 weeks on a kind of a bit of a quiet, well, me and Sirika went and stayed by the sea in a hotel, just the two of us, nobody else in the hotel for the last 2 weeks, well, nearly 2 weeks, just to get a bit of peacefulness. I have been thinking about all this sort of thing for quite a long time. I think it was about three and a half years ago I gave a talk on imagination and play. I keep coming back to the same topics really, but each time I come back to them, having been around the houses with all the other things to do with mindfulness, I come back and there's another thing just slots into place a bit more. So I imagine that this process may go on for quite a long time. You know, it might be 10 years that I'm actually working on this. But I just think that, I know that in the past, people used to sort of say, you know, it's good to just spend a good chunk of time just reflecting on the Dharma, you know, like spend years just working on, one topic or thinking about one topic. And Sangharakshita has done that over years, you know, from when he first became a monk in the late 40s or whatever. He's obviously thought about things a lot. And I just think if you just imagine that everything that's come about in terms of the FWO and the Western Buddhist Order and all that has come about because one person actually carried on thinking about things, it sort of says something that just thinking itself is quite powerful, I just get the sense that if there'd been any kind of loopholes in his thinking, that would have unravelled things. But I think there's something about being thorough that actually gives everything quite a strong ground. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about imagination and something called the imaginal faculty. So, basically, I'm going to talk a little bit about imagination first of all, and then go into sort of more specific ideas. So, I'm going to talk about Buddhist ideas around imagination, and Sangharakshita. And him talking about the imaginal faculty, which he sort of took from Coleridge. A little bit about William Blake and different personality types in Buddhism, because I think that's related to how people imagine things. I'm going to go into my own interest, some of the ideas that I've been working on over the last 5 years. I'm going to go into what is the image. So imagination sort of is always preceded by an image. And in particular, I'm going to sort of talk about the image as a mental object. So mental objects is one of the four foundations of mindfulness that the Buddha asked us to bring our attention to. I'm going to talk a bit about identity, that a person's identity is a kind of mental object. So when you say I, or you identify with yourself as a Buddhist or a Christian or whatever it is a mental object, and that has some sort of knock. That has some sort of effect on your life, really. So it's like it's an imagining. It's a kind of a a naming of yourself. You're imagining yourself in a particular as a particular thing, and that has an effect one way or another. You know, a little bit about how identity is tied up with disposition. What disposition you have or don't have, and the different views around that, like the Hindu view, kind of Hindu view versus the Buddhist view, and a bit about fantasy and the difference between fantasy and imagination, and then a section on meditating and meditating with the imagination. And finishing off with a bit about magic. You know, what is magic? Okay, it's quite a lot there, really, isn't there? See how we get on. So imagination. You know, I think if you know, you've got to take the term as it's used in society generally. So, you know, it's commonly sort of seen as like some kind of flamboyance, or you know, it's associated with flamboyance, with like often with sort of negative connotations, like fantasy or you know, imagination running wild and that sort of thing. And this is perhaps a sort of prejudice that comes in a society which is largely dominated by reason. You know, it came out of the sort of the Enlightenment of the 18th century, and you know, after sort of and that was a reaction to sort of irrational forms of sort of religion, really. So, but it's like the rational dominates. So, imagination has a bit of a little bit of a bad image. Although, it, you know, people do recognise the value of imagination in things like creating new you know, breakthroughs in science or whatever. Sangharakshita talks about the imaginal faculty. And Subhuti, in his book Sangharakshita, A New Voice in the Buddhist Tradition, he quotes him saying, "We may say that we know something, but we know it only with the conscious mind, with the rational part of ourselves. We know it theoretically, intellectually, abstractly. But we must recollect that man is not just his conscious mind. He's not all reason, though he may like to think he is. There is another part of us, a much larger part that than we care to admit, which is no less important than our reason. This part is made up of instinct, of emotion, of volition, and is more unconscious than conscious. And this wider, deeper, and no less important part of ourselves is not touched at all by our rational or intellectual knowledge, but it goes its own way, as it were, dragging the mental part, still protesting, along with it." He says that, talks about the conflict between the head and the heart, between reason and emotion, conscious and unconscious mind, and that what Sangharakshita terms the imagination, borrowing from Coleridge, or the imaginal faculty, is closely connected with Shraddha, or faith, and is an intuitive response to the ideal that leads one onto the path. Primarily, imagination is the faculty whereby we perceive the images through which the archetypes express themselves. Here, images can be understood as the objects of any sense. So there's something about you know, the imaginal faculty which combines reason and emotion, And it's talked about as a kind of, it's easy, I think it's easy to, reason and emotion tend to be sort of seen as like, not opposites, but sort of, you're either reasonable or you're emotional. But to combine two things, you know, so to be reasonable and emotional is like harder than to just be one or the other. So I think this is where this thing of imagining the Buddha with the whole of our being comes in, or the imaginal faculty. It's like trying to have a sense of the rational side and the emotional side combining into what's called a higher third, where you not only do you can you sort of are you interested in things making sense, you're behind them, you know, you're emotionally sort of committed to them. So you know, when we have any sort of poetry, it often has these two sides. There's often a message in the poetry. There's some sort of teaching, or usually a around beauty or impermanence or whatever. But with it comes a way. The structure of the poem is such that it gives us a way of actually. Well, it shunts our emotions into gear, you know, and it gives us something. Delight or that feeds us emotionally. So it's a bit like it does both. It does the rational side and it feeds the emotional side. And any form of like Buddhist devotion is like that really. It's got a teaching side to it, like the Sevenfold Puja, and it's got a poetic side. And William Blake, he sort of says about the spiritual life that, you know, it's not, it always has to have reason in it, you know, so it's not all about things feeling nice, you know, there needs to be that sort of, they need to make sense as well, you know, they need to sort of sit well with our rational faculty. Okay. Right, so my perennial topic is the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. It's the one I keep working on. I've been working on it for the last 5 years. So these are the four things that the Buddha asks us to bring our attention to. And the normally in the Satipatthana Sutta, they're arranged in a sequence. So first of all, we bring attention to the body, and then we bring attention to feeling, to states of mind, and then to mental objects. And I think there's a reason why we have this sort of sequence. I think primarily because this sequence reflects what is actually kind of a bit what's more and more closer to what's important to us. What's easier to bring attention to? So the easiest thing to bring attention to is the body, or you could say, I normally think of this as actual tangible experience in the present moment. So it's hard enough to bring attention to that. You know, your mind wanders off, but you know, if you can bring yourself back to it, to you know, some tangible experience without much feeling content in it, it's relatively easy. Now, if you then bring in feeling, so especially strong feeling, it's a bit harder to pay attention, you know, if you've got a lot of pain going on or if you've got a lot of pleasure going on, because, you know, you you want to flee, or you want to sort of get into it too much. And then, it, you know, as you go up, it's like things become more and more closer to home. So states of mind, you tend to think, well, yeah, my states of mind, you know, my ethics, and we can be a bit protective about that, you know, not really wanting to admit, you know, what state of mind we're in. And then it's even worse when we get to views or mental objects. It's like, you know, you start to sort of question somebody's views, or, you know, it's like they can get really heated because it's just very close to home. Because in a way, everyone likes to think that, you know, they know what's happening or they know what's going on. So there is this sequence, and, you know, traditionally I think you work this way up, and you sort of work on your body first, and then work on being aware of your feelings in the context of your body, and then up like that. But I think one of the things I realised when I was this year that I was actually doing with my book was bringing together two things. The Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which is one of the main paths in Buddhism, and conditionality, which is its central doctrine, conditioned co-production. So, and this conditioned co-production, conditionality, is essentially this being. So anything being, something else, it has an effect somewhere else, so that becomes. So this diagram brings these two things together, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness and conditionality. So how we you know, think about the world, for instance, like mental objects, has an effect on our feeling, you know, puts us in a particular mood. It has an effect on what's embodied in the world, you know, it translates into something in the world, something tangible. And it has an effect on our state of mind, you know. So if we, you know, for instance, if the mental object in our mind is that people are just objects, then we're in a state of sort of indifference to them. Or if we have a mental object that people are, you know, feeling, you know, beings in need of care, then we generate a state of metta. So there's a whole sort of network of relationships here, if we consider any of one of these affecting any other. In this talk, I want to sort of focus on, in particular, imagination. So, mental objects can be, you know, a name that you have. You know, what objects do we have in our minds? We have like names, you know, we name things, or we have pictures. You know, we have a picture of an ice cream that we would like, and then that has some sort of effect in all the different directions. So it's like, well, what we imagine, you know, I think the imaginal faculty, you know, it's like, well, it's a bit like reflecting on what's the effect of what it is that we imagine. So if we imagine that we are a fixed, unchanging being, you know, that we'll only be happy if we have $10,000 in the bank or whatever, then that has a certain effect on what comes about. You know, it's not very likely that we will, if that isn't true, so, you know, if that is actually an incorrect view about the world, then it will lead. It won't lead anywhere. It won't lead to a good sort of outcome. But if we imagine that, you know, we're a fluid, changing being that is can possibly be destined for enlightenment, then that raises all sorts of possibilities as to, well, it raises that as a possibility of happening. So I think, there is this, you know, Buddhist phrase, what we dwell on, we become. And the word used for, you know, what the mind dwells on, the mind used there is manas, and I think this is associated with manas, mental objects. It is taking these conditioning links seriously. It's a bit like, when there's that phrase about lack of repetition is the bane of the spiritual life or something. And it's like saying, well, what you need to do is just keep repeating over and over again, you know, what is really important. And it's like trying to bring an image of enlightenment there into your consciousness, as regularly as possible, because there will always be some image or other going on. You know, if it's not that, it's likely to be something else. So it's likely to be another view. Yeah. So, we can set up some sort of, we do it all the time, but we can do it more consciously. We can set up some sort of identity for ourselves here, you know, by choosing what mental images we use or mental objects we use. And people do this all the time. You know, so, when some guys, you know, playing Warcraft or something like that, or, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, they're kind of imagining themselves as a white knight on a charger. And, you know, it's kind of makes them feel good. Maybe that doesn't sort of lead anywhere. And I think that's the difference between fantasy and imagination, that imagination leads somewhere, whereas fantasy doesn't. So you can have an identity, but unless that actually manifests here in reality, you know, as whatever the image is, it doesn't, you know, if you imagine yourself as a Buddha, but you never turn into a Buddha, then it's fantasy. But if you imagine yourself as a Buddha, well, if you never imagine yourself as a Buddha, it's not likely that you'll, you know, turn into a Buddha. But if you imagine yourself as a Buddha and then you do everything you can to make that happen, then that's imagination. So I think one of the things about imagining the Buddha with the whole of our being is we have an image which leads, you know, it's the lead faculty, really. And I think it works differently for different people. You know, if you're an artist or something, you probably you've got a visual image that is the lead thing. You know, you're inspired or drawn on by a visual image. But not everybody's like that. Some people are more tactile. You know, they like working with the hands, or perhaps, you know, it's a sort of skillful general who's good at sort of marshalling his troops and strategy and all that. So there's imagination in all of those things, but it's it's kind of manifesting, it's being led in a different way, you know, with different people. And I think often the challenge isn't what's leading, it's all the other stuff that needs to catch up. So it might be that a general is absolutely fantastic at slaughtering the enemy, but what he needs to learn about is ethics, you know. He needs to bring his ethical faculty up to the level of his skill in warfare, you know, in order to sort of become enlightened, you know. And there is that story about the, you know, the thief who wanted to become a better thief, and the Zen master says, well, learn mindfulness. And he learned mindfulness and he started to empathise with the people he was stealing from. So, yeah. So, and I think in the, this points to a difference between, like, say, the Hindu view, or I think there's a similarity in Western society with the Hindu view that it's all right. The Hindu view is basically that it's all right to just develop part of yourself. You know, you become a great poet, you become a, you know, you practice one thing, one yoga, to the nth degree, and you leave everything else out. Whereas the Buddhist view is more that you bring all of your faculties up, you know, to the highest level, and you balance yourself out rather than becoming imbalanced. So if you just develop yourself as an artist and you label yourself an artist, blah blah blah, and you fit in society as an artist, that's fine for, you know, if you've got a society which is just everyone's like a cog in the wheel. You know, everyone fits in a particular slot. But it holds you back from really developing yourself as an individual, you know, which you can only do if you develop across the board. So if you are an artist, you need to develop the other, you know, the sides that are, you know, a bit more rational and a bit more embodied, you know, making things happen a bit more. You know, if you live in your dreams a lot, you know. Yeah. So I think often we will have a particular one type faculty or another that actually we're fluid in. You know, so somebody might be kind of quite fluid with the body and they become a sportsman, you know. It's like, in a way, they speak the language of the body. Or you might be fluid in visual signs and symbols and you're an artist, or, you know, whatever it is. So it's like you have this kind of, you can have a fluidity in one or another faculty. You know, but the challenge is to then bring everything else up to that. So, okay, so I'm just going to say a bit about meditating with the imagination. So, you know, as I sort of pointed out a bit here with the example about the Metta Bhavana, imagination is there, really, in one way or another, in all meditation. So if you say mindfulness of breathing, so in what ways is it present there? Well, you do the mindfulness of breathing because you imagine that, well, you're able to imagine that the possibility that you might not have it all sussed, you know, that you might not actually be present in the present moment, you know, because people that haven't taken up meditation and they're not, in a way, the stage before that, before even imagining that there is anything, you know, that they're not aware. So it's like you're able to imagine that you're not aware. With the Metta Bhavana, you start to sort of be able to sort of see, imagine more what life is like for other people, and then you know you start to act in a different way towards them. And then there's all this stuff about around identity. So other meditations later on in sort of in the system of meditation, Sangharakshita's system, work on getting a kind of truer picture of your actual situation. That you know you are more fluid than you think. You know, and actually the fixed self is a bit of a fiction. And then later on, you know, people will sort of take up some, you know, if they join the order, they'll get introduced to like a visualization meditation practice, which then helps. I've been thinking about this, like why do we only sort of teach visualization meditation to order members? And I think there's something about a kind of rite of passage. So it's a bit like getting ordained is like a rite of passage, and then you sort of take on a bit of a new identity. You get a new name, and you take on a sort of visualization meditation. So it's like you can only really take on a new on do that on the basis of really being kind of behind it, having a sort of strong enough will behind it, but also kind of actually being manifest to a real enough degree within you. So if you actually took up a regular, if you gave yourself a Buddhist name and took up a sadhana practice, visualization practice, without having somebody else giving it to you, or who's got a lot of experience, or have witnessed that, and in witnessing it, they're saying, that's all right, I think that you're ready for this, then it might actually be quite destructive to you to do that, because the fact that you might start disintegrating around it. You know, so instead of it, if you weren't, if that was unrealistic as an identity, you know, to try and hold on to it might actually be destructive. Because what we're trying to do is we're trying to build all these up together. So we're trying to build up a identity, but also in conjunction with it being something real happening, you know, and in conjunction with being sort of emotionally behind it, and able to sort of have confidence. So the confidence is an example of a state of mind. So we need to have sort of confidence as well, and that only comes through experience, you know. So I wanted to say a bit of before I finish about using imagery or using imagery in meditation, because you know I think you probably will have been sort of taught stuff about you know a lotus opening in the heart with metta bhavana or whatever, but I think maybe it's possible that given that the situation, the background situation of the world as it is, being a bit rational and scientific and all that sort of stuff, that you know you might feel a bit inhibited about doing that, or think you know this is fantasy or whatever. But I think so long as what you do has the effect of bringing you a bit closer towards enlightenment, and it might be that it just gives you more confidence. You know, it might be that you could actually, imagine yourself, or in a way, you know, give yourself some sense of identity in a way which just sort of shifts your confidence a bit more. And it might be that you do that through using an image or you. I mean, one thing I do is I imagine that I'm sort of filled with a kind of soothing nectar that is somehow coming from the Buddha. You know, it's like it's a sort of a. So you can imagine, you can. One thing I do is. I'm a bit visual, and you know, so I will take the gold of the Buddha, the golden colour, and I will sort of imagine that that represents certain sort of qualities, like magical qualities that somehow are present in the Buddha's experience. So the Buddha is, you know, I don't know what he's experiencing, but you know, I can kind of guess that. Well, you read all about sort of the bliss of release and all sort of, you know, being sort of 16 times whatever, blah blah. You know, it's like, so you can actually try and contact that in your imagination. You know, what must it actually be like to be having the experience of enlightened consciousness, where there is actually, you're not afraid of anything, so there's no reason for you to have any sort of holding or tension in your body. And that your mind can just is just free to play in its own way, and you know, it's not sort of you know, afraid of anything. It's not kind of restricted in any way. So, you know, what I do is I sort of try and build up in the imagination a sort of you know, kind of fantastic kind of Mahayana type. Image of what enlightenment must be like, and then I kind of imagine that actually coming over and to me, you know, and me experiencing that, and I find it quite encouraging that but it actually does encourage me to think it's simple in a way. It's just sort of saying, well, yeah, you know, this is you're just prefiguring what it might be like. And I think, you know, often I have a lot of tension in my body, so it really helps me. It sort of meets one of my main needs, you know. So it's hard to then translate that into what you might do, because as I said, everybody's different. You know, we've got like different, you know, sort of leading faculties, or you might be quite at ease in your body, but you know, it may be sort of thinking might be something that's a bit harder or something like that. So I can't really say, you know, but I just think that there's more possibilities, there's more that we might consider, you know, than just what we're sort of used to. So I think that's, you know, I think that is actually using the imagination. You know, it's kind of, it's opening up to what's beyond, you know, just our kind of normal, you know, way of thinking about things. And, yeah, so for me, like that sort of magical, something magical is often feeds me quite a lot, you know, because, you know, maybe it's something that's sort of a bit missing in me, you know. I sort of, you know, thinking about this, I sort of thought, well, hang on, so what is magic? You know, what's magic? It, you know, so if you've got a magician and they pull a rabbit out of a hat, so, you know, it's like you sort of, you know, well, the reason we think that's magical is we don't know where it's come from. It's a mystery where the rabbit has come from, because it shouldn't be in the hat, and it's pulled out. So I think maybe, you know, I can broaden this out to just what's magical in general. So what's magical in general is when something happens out of the, you know, it just comes from nowhere, and we don't know where it's come from. And it's a bit like we, you know, you might sit in meditation. It's a bit magical, isn't it? You sit in meditation, you watch your breath, and you get up 20 minutes later and some sort of transformation's happened. How did that happen? All you were doing is just sitting watching your breath. But there's something about kind of... the other reason it's magical is that we don't know what the conditions were that brought it about. So we don't know what the conditions were that brought the rabbit out of the hat. But if we knew, it wouldn't be magical. So there's something about just being kind of open to conditions beyond what we know, and letting those affect us, or working with those, you know, working, not sort of thinking that we've got it all sorted out and that we know, and well, you know, because we just then do this habitual thing of sitting on the cushion, doing it in a certain way every time, blah, blah, blah. We're not open to anything sort of coming in from outside of ourselves to give us a surprise, or to, you know, to yeah. So there's something, I think, the key to bringing magic into the world, really, is something about conditionality, something about conditions, and not thinking that you kind of know all the conditions that they're actually at play on you. And I think, you know, if you start to open up to the sort of broader conditions that actually are there, but, you know, you're not aware of them, then actually I think things do become a bit more magical.